Happy Thanksgiving to those of you who are celebrating it. And to everybody, no matter what you're doing today, welcome to Listen Local. We, the staff of Mission Local, are out today. But if you're tuned in, we've put something together for you. We like to call it our Thanksgiving Story Hour. It's really only a half an hour, but these are stories that Mission Local has written or produced over the years that are just a little bit quirky or funny and hopefully fun to listen to. My name is Laura Wenis. I'm one of the reporters at Mission Local who usually brings you this program. Today we're going to hear from all kinds of folks who have worked for Mission Local over the years, including Lydia Chavez, who is our executive editor, founder, and a professor at the UC Berkeley J School. You'll also hear from Julian Mark, who recently came onto our staff full-time but has done some great work for us in the past, and you'll hear some of his more recent and some of his older pieces. And you'll also hear from Ben Pavier, who was never officially a Mission Local reporter, but has done some great audio pieces for us, and he's off in Cambodia right now. I'll introduce each of these reporters as they're about to tell their story. I'll get to tell a story as well. But first, we're going to take you on a food journey. A few years ago, our editor, Lydia, started a column, Perfect or Not. Lydia has very high standards, but sometimes a food will pass muster. One such food was a special ice cream. Have a listen.
Perfect or not? We can blame Chad Robertson for this column. He set the gold standard by consistently turning out perfectly chewy, crusty, memorable loaves at Tartine Bakery every day. When foodies make such a monumental deal about food, why shouldn't we expect perfection in every bite? So while others give you reviews, Perfect or Not, launched on May 12, 2014, seeks perfection one dish at a time. Since launching Perfect or Not, I've been eating a lot with that standard in mind, and it's hard to meet. There's always something just a little bit off. But then I bite into an ancient grain loaf from Tartine and decide that no, perfection does exist. I started thinking about Byright's Mexican chocolate ice cream with salted peanuts. I'm not a fan of chocolate, which is why I can still remember that first bite on a chilly fall day in 2008. Standing in front of the fireplace, I felt the heat of Oaxaca on my face, the sweet bitterness of mole on my tongue. The memory of Rodrigo and Mai. What I'm saying is, in my memory, it was perfect. But was it? I went to Byright on Saturday to get some for dinner. What? No Mexican chocolate with salted peanuts? Crazed, I read over and over again the list of ice creams for sale on the fogged-up freezer door. Argh! Maybe a pint was tucked away beside the prosaic vanillas and salted caramel. I opened the freezer door. Byright hates that because it raises the temperature inside. But when you're looking for perfection, you can't let anything, consideration of others, global warming, whatever, get in your way. A Byright employee walked up. I closed the door. Seasonal, said the cashier by way of explanation. How can that even be possible? I could see where strawberry or peach ice cream could be seasonal, but chocolate and peanuts? I got the hazelnut instead, and as it turns out, the hazelnut is good, but it isn't perfect. Still, nobody said this would be easy. Over the years, I have continued to look for the Mexican chocolate with salted peanuts, but it has never reappeared. Today, I heard from Sarah Holt from Byright, who said that Byright has, quote, no immediate plans to bring it back. No immediate plans. Might that mean that there may be some future plans? She did dissuade me from that interpretation by promising new flavors, and I look forward to trying those. But I can't help but think that she has left open a door, one with Mexican chocolate and salted peanuts inside.
You can find more Perfect or Not columns on missionlocal.org. Back before he went off to Cambodia to hold the local government accountable through journalism there, Ben Pavier created a few audio stories for Mission Local. He decided to profile some local entrepreneurs. In this story, he made contact with a couple of inventors, but I'll let him tell it.
Most entrepreneurs will tell you that starting a business is hard. It's a little like a long-term relationship. It takes passion, hard work, and lots of love. In The Mission, Lisa and Abe Fetterman are trying to do both. They're setting out to reinvent sous vide cooking and raise a baby while they're at it.
I mean, when he made the machine for me, I was like, I am totally marrying you.
That's Lisa. She and her husband, Abe, are the co-founders of Namaku, a company that makes immersion circulator cookers. With a $200 Namaku, home cooks can imitate the sous vide meals made by Michelin-starred chefs.
What you do is you put your ingredients inside of a bag and then put it in water that's circulated to a very precise temperature. And our machine circulates that water. It clips onto any pot you already own, circulates the water to a precise temperature, and then you cook in it.
The couple first met in 2010 at a New York gym. Abe was studying plasma physics at Princeton, and Lisa was a journalist who moonlighted in the restaurant business. Abe asked her on a date, and it quickly became clear that they shared an obsession with food. The day after their first date, Abe asked her to breakfast, and lunch, and then dinner, too. When Lisa mentioned she was interested in buying an immersion circulator, Abe didn't miss a beat.
So what I did was I went and got like some parts from Amazon and went to the hardware store and put something together for $50 when usually the machine is over $1,000.
As Abe continued to refine his design, their foodie friends became interested in his invention. The Fettermans began selling kits for home chefs to build circulators on their own. They sold like hotcakes.
Then that's what got us to go to China, make a prototype, come back to New York, where we were living before, 1 week before our wedding, beg our wedding videographers to make a Kickstarter video. And we put it on Kickstarter and becomes the number one most funded project at the time in food.
The couple went on to raise $500,000, hire 7 employees, and expand their line of Namakus. They also had a baby.
What it's like is like getting constantly punched in the face and you just have to take it. And then your face gets stronger.
These days, the Fettermans split their time between 2 babies, one in a crib in Noe Valley, and the other in a cramped office above a Mission Street GameStop. Even Lisa admits it's sometimes nice to have a little distance, but she shows no signs of slowing down.
I learn something new every week, and I never stop, and I can't stop.
For Mission Local, I'm Ben Pavier.
Ben also took some time to catch up with the maker of the Mission's favorite taco. Miguel Jara owns La Taqueria on Mission and 25th Streets. He's won dozens of accolades and awards, and back in 2015, Ben paid him a visit.
It's just past 11 a.m. on a Friday morning, and there's already a dozen people in line at La Taqueria. Everyone is here, men in suits with bolo ties, tattooed construction workers, and even a tight-lipped film crew from the Food Network. But for Miguel Jara, the owner of La Taqueria, it's just another Friday.
You know, I don't do anything special. Everybody does the same thing. But for some one reason or another, they made me the best burrito in the United States. You know?
6 months ago, 538, a famous statistics blog, named La Taqueria's burrito the best in the country. Overnight, lines stretched around the block. According to Jara, that popularity is nothing new. He traces it back to La Taqueria's opening day in March of 1973.
And the day I opened, boom, we came all kinds of people. I went home that night and I was making burritos. I dreamt that they were throwing burritos at me.
Jara wasn't always in the restaurant business. He grew up in Tijuana, Mexico, where there wasn't always enough money for food. For fun, he and his friends would hop over the American border to see a show.
And then the guys on the horses used to come over and chase us out. You know? So we jumped the fence. When they leave, they would jump over again.
In the late 50s, when he was just 16, Jara escaped the poverty of his hometown to seek work in the United States. Eventually, he established a successful body shop business in San Francisco. But Miguel had always loved tacos and dreamed of starting a restaurant of his own. One day, he announced to his father that he was quitting to pursue his dream.
I told him, Dad, you can have the body shop. I'm going to open a taco place.
What?
Have you ever worked in a restaurant?
No.
What do you know about this? Nothing. you're crazy. You do what you know how to do, which is the body shop. He said, no, I'm going to open the taco place.
He bought an old bar on Mission Street and spiffed it up on his own. Then he ran out of money and applied for a loan. The loan officer mistook Hara for hired help.
What way you came in? He said, through that door. Okay, use that door and get out of here. I don't need your money.
La Taqueria sold out by 2 p.m. on its first day. For more than 40 years, customers have kept coming back. Even Hara can't seem to get enough of the restaurant. Now 73 years old, he comes by regularly.
Look, I could be stressed out. I could be tired. I could have a pain here. Once I get over here, everything goes away.
For Mission Local, I'm Ben Pavier.
You can find Ben's other stories on missionlocal.org. This is our Thanksgiving Story Hour, where we revisit quirky stories and bring them to you in sound. Among my quirkiest stories this year was a tale of love and sex and plants. Yeah. A rare, stinky, and somewhat sexual spectacle that unfolded this summer at the San Francisco Conservatory of Flowers had its roots in a Mission District bathroom. Terra the Titan, a Titan arum plant, also known as the corpse flower, or by its scientific name, Amorphophallus titanum, produced a bloom. That is a momentous occasion, as the plant only manages to do that about once every 5 to 10 years, and when it does, it releases a staggering stench. The smell, akin to rotting flesh, lures pollinators like flies and beetles, usually attracted to corpses, to lay their eggs. The plant's natural habitat in the hilly rainforests of Indonesia is threatened by rampant deforestation, so botanical gardens around the nation have taken to raising the increasingly rare giant plants. That's how Sidney Price got involved. Price raised Terra the Titan arum in his Mission District bathroom, nursing it through about 4 years of domestic life before it grew too massive for the space. In 2010, Price had visited the UC Berkeley Botanical Garden to see a Titan arum in bloom, and he'd grown enamored. He told me, "It was just so beautiful. It's like looking at a Georgia O'Keeffe painting, except 100 times bigger. It's so beautiful, and I have to say it, kind of erotic. I fell in love." All this, even though he said you could smell it 100 feet from the enclosed building where it was blooming. This year, at 9 years of age, Terra produced her first bloom. The term corpse flower and the idea of giving a plant a male or female name is actually somewhat misleading. The gargantuan plant produces not one flower, but hundreds, in a cluster called an inflorescence, with both male and female flowers. It was actually a culturally fortuitous moment for the bloom. Pride. It's a time when the spectrum of gender expressions is celebrated along with the spectrum of sexualities. Price explained, "Traditionally, when you name the plant, it's considered a feminine plant in naming, but in reality, it's a hermaphrodite. It's an intersex plant. There are both male and female flowers within what people consider the flower, the bloom." The flowers in the inflorescence will open in sequence. Each opens just about a day to prevent self-pollination. In the wild, the timing of pollination is incredibly tricky. Two plants have to bloom in a rhythm that allows one to release pollen from its male flowers before the female flowers of a neighboring plant close up. With such long times between blooms, such a short flowering period, and a shrinking habitat, corpse flower reproduction can be a doomed romance. According to Price, the rarity of that happening, and also for another plant to be blooming at the same time within that 3 or 4 day period, the odds are just astronomical. As luck would have it, on the same visit during which Price originally discovered his love for Titan arum, the garden shop at Berkeley's Botanical Garden was selling corpse flower seedlings, 4-inch yellowish-green shoots in small pots. Price seized his chance and bought 2, which later turned out to be 3. At first, they languished by his kitchen window. Then he tried something different, his bathroom, equipped with a skylight. The soft light and the warmth and moisture of years of showers apparently served as the perfect emulator of a corpse flower's natural tropical habitat because the plants flourished. Price's dedication and care probably didn't hurt either. He used to threaten people that if they damaged the plant, he would throw them out. But he knew it couldn't last forever. In 2014, Price had to say goodbye, realizing that if he waited any longer, he wouldn't be able to get the towering plant out of the apartment without damaging it. He contacted the conservatory, which agreed to take Tara and its potmates in. After blooming, the plant withered and grew dormant, a cycle it undergoes periodically. But the plant's root, a large tuber, will remain alive and produce leaves, maybe even an inflorescence, once more. The full story of Tara the Titan is on missionlocal.org. Another story we covered was the opening of Café Landré. We sent our reporter Julian Mark to check it out on its very first day of squeaky clean operations.
The room looks like it's been through a heavy-duty bleach cycle, but I walk in anyway. It's 7:15 on Wednesday evening, and I'm at Café Landré, the half-café, half-laundromat, on the corner of 20th and Mission, on its first day in operation. People pass by its large windows on Mission Street and peek inside, perhaps wondering, really, another hip cafe? Or why is it so sterile in there? But some walk in, mill around, and even buy a cup of coffee. Others, like me, the brave, ask why a coffee shop would be named Landré. I find out there's a laundromat located in the back. So I go home and bring back some dirty clothes. I don't have detergent, so I'm offered liquid soap for $1, but I opt for the on-the-house powdered soap, which comes in a charming miniature white sand pail. There are three payment options, card, coins, or an app, which would also notify me when the cycle is finished. I download the app, but it doesn't work. I seek advice from a young woman, who I'm told is the owner. She frantically tries to get the app to work on my phone, rushing off to get her own phone to test it. She tells me I'm the first customer to try the app. After 5 minutes, I cut my losses and just use my card. The laundry area is lined with about 20 brand new Electrolux 450 G-Force washers, capable of adding the right amount of water based on your clothes' weight, as well as some 20 dryers that regulate heat based on how wet your clothes are. They give the room an undeniable Death Star effect. I can hear an old lady in the cafe area say, "What are you going to do with all this space?" A barista says, "I'm not sure, but it's nice having the space." "You should have dances, hip-hop dances," the lady says. It's true, the space is so large as to be intimidating, like outer space or the ocean. I order a decaf cappuccino, which is expertly made, complete with a pristine latte leaf on top. The young owner offers to comp my drink because the app didn't work, but I pay the $2.70 anyway. There's a food menu, too. For $15, you can have a vegan rice bowl, or for $5, a croissant, or a $12 salad. The salad's containers have the logo Landré wrapped around them. There are also bottles of green smoothie in an ice case, whose price I'm too afraid to check. My laundry is finished, and it's time for me to leave. But I end up introducing myself to the owner, the woman who helped me with the app, and I cop to it. I am, after all, a writer. I ask the owner, whose name is Ariana Roviello, why she decided to open a cafe laundromat in the Mission. She explains that Landré was her senior project in college. She studied fashion but ended up falling in love with laundry during her research. "I thought it would be interesting to create a place where you could wash your fashion," she said. After graduating, she worked in the fashion industry but eventually left her job in September 2014 to pursue opening the business. She became a Lyft driver for 2 years while she drafted her business plans, found some outside funding, and selected a space. She thought the Mission was a good place to open because of its high population of renters, who don't have their own laundry machines. "It's been 3 years to the day since I quit my job that I'm opening," she said. Roviello says she's operating on 2 hours of sleep, and she has been at the cafe all night getting it ready for today's soft opening. "So I decide to leave her alone, go home, and fold my clothes for tomorrow. Am I more fulfilled as a human? Maybe not. Are my clothes clean? Yes. And why would I want anything more than that?"
It's worth noting that since that story ran, Café Landry has added some additional furniture and seems to be attracting some customers both to the café and to the laundromat. It's not all neat, clean stories for Julian, though. Last year, we sent him to observe a performance artist's piece about street harassment. She'd posted herself up in the window of Artist Television Access on Valencia Street to call attention to catcalling.
You think you're better than me? Ooh, those legs. Hey, freak, wanna suck my dick?
Mirabelle Jones is on display. She has just climbed into the gallery window at Artist Television Access in plain view of passersby on Valencia Street. She paces in circles, subjecting herself to the kinds of comments she says women experience every day.
You single? You want to fuck? I can smell your pussy. I love how thick you are.
Jones will do this for the next 8 hours. The walls are covered in crowdsourced catcalls, and razor blades hang from balloons on the ceiling. More balloons are added regularly, shrinking the space she has to move. It's a piece of performance art Jones hopes will bring attention to street harassment.
It's an amazing representation of how women feel all the time, every day, which is that there's an aspect of being objectified and harassed that's not talked about because it's just part of your daily life, and it's an aspect of fear that only women understand.
That's Elaine Sue. She says she's catcalled at least 4 or 5 times a week.
It can be anything as small as like a honk to a hiss to all the stuff that she has here written on the balloons.
Ava, who was watching Jones's exhibit with her parents, is only 13 years old, and already she's catcalled on a regular basis.
When I was younger, when people first started commenting on like my body, I wasn't really conscious of it before. And then I started to get like self-conscious about how I looked and like my weight. And I feel like those comments just really, even if they think they're being nice or they're giving you a compliment, it really doesn't help.
George Lopez says he's never used any of the more violent or offensive comments used in Jones's exhibit.
I tell lady, excuse me, you are so lovely, beautiful, you know, I have to say it.
But when complimenting strangers, he's had mixed results.
Some ladies say, oh, thank you, smile, and say, oh, thank you. Some ladies say, thank you for your harassment. I just say something good, you know, and why they feel like that?
It can be flattering sometimes, but sometimes it's like totally straight up rude and disrespectful to a woman, so, or to a man.
Rebecca Rose said that very recently she was harassed coming home from a bar downtown.
He's like, do you want to suck my dick? And I'm like, no, I do not. And then he pulls it out. He's like, you sure about this? And he like, you know, trying to show it to me, like how cool. I was like, my husband's is way bigger than yours. Because I was actually scared. I was a little nervous because I'm like, what is he going to do? You know, is he going to like try to smack my face with it? I don't know.
Eventually, Rose said, a military officer standing nearby stepped in and told the guy to get lost. But for Mirabelle Jones, victims of harassment should not be responsible for stopping it. She says they shouldn't have to devise methods like wearing headphones or clinging to a nearby person for safety.
The problem is not that we don't know what to do when we experience street harassment. The problem is we should not be harassed on the street. That should not happen, period.
Growing up in West Oakland, Jones received her share of harassment on the street, but she often felt powerless against it. That's why, in recent years, Jones has spent much of her time working with anti-harassment organization Holla Back. She also founded her own organization, Art Against Assault, which stages shows like this one to call attention to street harassment and rape culture. For Jones, however, there's still a long way to go.
It's something that I think men have to do with each other, and they have to really acknowledge, oh, this is going on the other side of the fence. Let's discuss this and maybe try to do better.
For Mission Local, I'm Julian Mark.
You can find images of that performance piece at missionlocal.org. We hope you've enjoyed this collection of Mission District stories. We'll be back 2 weeks from today with news and commentary on neighborhood happenings. Thanks for listening.